bean juice. Human bean juice. Welcome to Twerpcast episode 23, The Watchcast. Who watches The Watchcast? Technically no one. You listen to The Watchcast. Anyways, you may have guessed that this week we're going to discuss Watchmen, the movie. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to executive producer and last remaining Facebook-less person on the planet Earth, James Caswell.
And that was Doug Zeitlin, executive producer of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, and the only man to dress as Batmite for the past 12 years straight for Halloween.
Well, Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about Watchmen and where it comes from?
The Watchmen was originally a 12-issue limited series published from 1986 to 1987 from DC Comics. It was written by Alan Moore, art by Dave Gibbons, and colored by John Higgins. It was originally written with the newly acquired Charlton characters in mind, but when DC realized that using those characters would eliminate any possible use of them in the future, they asked Alan Moore to create new characters. But if you look at the characters carefully, and the old Charlton characters, you can see several similarities. Rorschach was The Question. Night Owl was Blue Beetle. Ozymandias was Peter Cannon. Dr. Manhattan, Captain Atom. And the comedian was Peacemaker. The only semi-original concept that they came up with was Silk Spectre, who didn't truly have a Charlton counterpart. They did have a character by the name of Nightshade, but Nightshade had powers and abilities and wasn't a second-generation heroine. So a direct similarity really can't be drawn between the two. Alan Moore said that he actually based Silk Spectre more on the idea of Black Canary and Phantom Lady.
They did a good job of substituting these characters and telling the story that they wanted to tell with the Watchmen comic book. Honestly, at the time, I had no familiarity with Charlton. It's only looking back at history retrospectively, having read the old Charlton characters and the Watchmen, that I see the similarities now. I'm glad they didn't use the Charlton characters, because I like them, and I wouldn't want to have disappeared yet again to history.
Well, one of the things that I find rather humorous is the fact that DC didn't want to use the Charlton characters because they realized that they'd never be able to use them again. Here we are 22 years later, and they've killed off The Question. They've killed off Ted Kord, who was the Blue Beetle. They've killed off Peacemaker two or three times. They've rendered Captain Atom morally ambiguous and kind of godlike in powers. And Peter Cannon has all but disappeared from DC continuity because they no longer own the license to that character. Hindsight being 2020, I have to kind of question, why'd they bother?
It's comic book continuity that every single person that they've killed off in the DC universe has come back in some form or another.
Now we're just waiting for Bruce Wayne to come back. Again.
There's not a single character that they've killed off, written out, that they haven't brought back. Even characters they said, we will never bring them back. Jason Todd is never coming back. Barry Allen is never coming back. And, you know, you wait 20 years and they come back.
He probably could have used the Charlton comic characters and still reworked things so that they could have come back. But
they absolutely could have. DC was very famous for coming up with an alternate line that was actually, I believe, called Elseworld, where it was just all about DC characters and what if. They had Gotham by Gaslight. They had Red Sun, what if Superman landed in Russia. They had this entire line of comics that was just supposed to be, what if you take these characters out of their normal situations and put them in another situation? It would have been very easy for them to take just the Charlton characters and put them in an Elseworld comic.
But let's be honest. If they had actually used the Charlton characters, I don't think it would have been the comic that it was in the end. Creating these new characters, giving us people that we had never been associated with before, made it easier for readers to understand, accept the decisions that these characters were making. If The Question had been this psychopath that Rorschach was, people would have kind of looked strange and gone, that's not how The Question would have behaved. Yes, people were doing that even 22 years ago.
I guess I half agree and half disagree with that. I think even in the late 80s, there's still a strong contingent of people who were still new to comic books and had no idea who any of the Charlton characters were. I had not heard of them before Crisis on Infinite Earths, only to be completely rewritten. The other part of that is the people that grew up reading the Charlton comics, I think they would have been offended. this is not the character that I grew up with.
I really do believe that it was a good thing that DC didn't let Moore use the Charlton characters. And Watchmen as a self-contained story would have suffered from using them because of the fact that DC would have come along later and said, oh yeah, no, no, no. These characters that we killed off, they're fine. The characters that we said turned into bad guys, they're fine. And it wouldn't have had the lasting cultural impact that it has today.
Stereotypically, the DC comic line has been the overgrown Boy Scout. Superman does no wrong, but really what started to grow out of this time period was these characters being written against stereotype.
It wasn't until the 80s and books like The Watchmen that heroes started to become more morally questionable. Yes, there were characters like Wolverine out there, but he really didn't start taking the limelight like he is known now until The Watchmen was published, because DC took a adventurous step forward and said, okay, what if our heroes aren't white hats? What if they're morally gray? What if what we think of as the standard superhero isn't how somebody would be acting in real life? And it's all these questions that led to The Watchmen becoming one of the great pieces of graphic literature of the time. It's considered right up there with The Dark Knight Returns. If you've collected or shown any interest in comic books since the 1980s, you've heard of these comics. Of course, the fact that this did become what people would consider a great piece of graphic literature could be one of the contributions to why Alan Moore has such a problem with Hollywood. Alan Moore left DC Comics in 1989. He felt as though they swindled him out of the Watchmen characters rather than return the rights to him like what was in his contract. When they drew up the contract for this comic, there was a stipulation in there that if DC Comics didn't do anything with the Watchmen line for a year, the rights would revert back to Alan Moore. The fact that he thought that he ever had the chance of getting his hands on Watchmen in the first place, I think was a little bit of a pipe dream on his part, because there were basically two things that could have potentially happened. Either A, it would be a complete success, like it was, and DC would go, oh, this is a complete success. We can make more money off of this. Let's keep a hold of the rights. Or it would have bombed, and he wouldn't have wanted the rights in the first place, because what are you going to do with the rights to something that's completely bombed out and nobody's interested in? So from my point of view, it almost seems like he was mad because DC was smart enough to ensure that if it was something that would make money, they'd continue to make money off of it.
As a comic book person himself, Moore should have realized that this is par for the course in comic books. DC Comic Book has held the rights to Superman from the Siegel and Schuster estates for decades. And only a recent lawsuit gave any back royalties to the families. DC has been fighting with Marvel for years over the rights to the name Captain Marvel. Every year you'll notice that a Captain Marvel comic book comes out of Marvel Comics to keep the rights from that name to reverting to DC.
This is the hazard of dealing with big business. And he realized this, and as can be seen in The Watchmen, he's had a long-standing bias against big business, corporate America, and the establishment, so he didn't like what DC did, and he left. The fact that he was surprised that this would happen in the first place is the only part that makes me scratch my head and go, eh?
It does show a little bit of naivete on his part.
So he went off and he did some independent stuff and then came back to DC and left DC, and he's been bouncing around out there for quite a while. And for what it's worth, a good chunk of the stuff that he has done has been popular enough that Hollywood has gone, hey, I like that, we want to make a film adaptation of it. He was the one who created The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He created V for Vendetta. He created From Hell. And he created The Watchmen. Strangely enough, in spite of the fact that they've given him a paycheck on every single one of these films, but with every single film that they've put out, he has complained and moaned and groaned and talked to the press and bad-mouthed Hollywood and complained some more because they're not upholding his initial artistic vision, and they've made changes to the story, and heaven forbid, somebody made an editor to. And he just rips the movies to shreds without ever having seen them, because it's not his original work.
Tough. As my junior high school teachers once said, tough toenails bite hard. The movie is not his artistic vision. It is a movie based on his artistic vision. And I don't see a problem with that. The Star Trek movies were not the Star Trek television show. The Battlestar Galactica new series is not Battlestar Galactica the old series. When somebody re-envisions work that was created by someone else, there's going to be changes. That doesn't inherently mean it's bad, it just means it's inherently different.
You don't hear J.K. Rowling griping and complaining because they've made changes here and there to the Harry Potter films. Anyone who has paid any attention to any form of adaptation realizes that sometimes you need to make cuts. Sometimes things move at a different speed in a comic book or in a book that just won't work on film. And you have to go on in and you have to change it. But there are enough purists out there that go, no, 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 I want to see it just the way it was in the book. That they get their panties in a bunch and moan and groan on the internet and just need to get over it.
I say that to my fellow Star Trek fans out there. J.J. Abrams' Star Trek is not going to be the Gene Roddenberry's, and thank God it's not going to be the Rick Berman's. It's going to be the J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. That's fine. I have no problem with that. It's just a new vision. That being said, someone like J.K. Rowling has managed to have a little more creative control over the movies. They've actually asked for her input, which is something that doesn't happen on every movie.
And it's funny because the people who put together Watchmen went to Alan Moore and said, we want you to have some input here. We want you to participate. Come and work with us. And he refused. And yet he still goes and gripes and complains, says that the Watchmen story is unfilmable, and is boycotting the film, refuses to see it, when he had the opportunity to have some input.
The arrogance to say that it's unfilmable. He is a comic book writer. He is not part of the industry establishment in Hollywood. Now granted, a lot of people in Hollywood are stupid, but that being said, every year a few good movies do come out of there.
So, we come to Watchmen the movie. It has been made. They did find ways to make it filmable, and I thought it was a very enjoyable film.
It certainly was a very enjoyable film. My biggest complaint of the whole movie would be it felt a little bit too long for me. It was just slightly under 3 hours, and it felt like it was just slightly under 3 hours.
Actually, from my own perspective, I will argue that, because my viewpoint on movies is it's only too long if I feel like I should be looking at a clock wondering how much time is left on this. And I never got that feeling with this film. I felt as though the story kept moving at a nice pace, and I never really wondered how much is left.
So, you know, we've had this discussion on other movies. I know that you thought King Kong was a little bit long, and I was ready for another 30 minutes.
It's all a matter of perspective.
Exactly. So this is one of those cases where by the time there was 30 minutes left, I was looking at my watch.
Whereas we got to the final scenes of the movie, and I went, okay, I could sit here for another half hour.
That being said, that's my worst complaint about the movie. I love the fact that it was essentially a cast of unknown names. Not nobodies, but it wasn't filled with A-list movie stars.
I would agree that if they'd tried to cast somebody like Tom Cruise as Ozymandias, I think it would have actually have suffered.
I agree with that, because as opposed to the story being about the Watchmen, it would be the vehicle of this famous star. And even if it weren't just Tom Cruise, I mean, you could add any three people as these are the big names. We're going to get Tom Cruise is going to be Ozymandias, and we're going to get Christian Bale to be the Night Owl, and we're going to get Gwyneth Paltrow as Silk Spectre. Then you're watching them, you're not watching the story.
Not that Gwyneth Paltrow was bad in Iron Man.
I have no complaints with Gwyneth Paltrow. I think she's a wonderful actress and a beautiful woman. But Iron Man was a vehicle move. The story is very small. It was fun. It was action-filled. I loved Gwyneth Paltrow in it. I loved Robert Downey Jr. I mean, there was nothing that was wrong with this movie. But it's a two-dimensional movie. This is how he becomes Iron Man. This is why he fights and why he does what he is. Whereas The Watchmen is a much richer story. Where these characters came from is not important. I mean, we don't know Night Owl's origin. We don't know Silk Spectre's origin. What's really important is the story and what they're trying to accomplish.
Of course you're going to love Rorschach. He's pretty much the lead character. Jackie Earle Haley did a great job portraying both the heroic aspect and the psychopath aspect of the character. But the person that I actually thought stood out even a little bit more was Patrick Wilson as the Night Owl. I thought he did a great job of both portraying the beaten down hero, the one who has pretty much given up and has accepted the fact that his time has passed. And yet, he does a dramatic turnaround and steps forward as a true hero who recaptures the fire within.
I think he's an interesting characterization because he's not a Clark Kent Superman. He is Clark Kent on one side and Batman on the other side.
And I felt like Wilson actually was able to capture the feel of what was happening to this character.
I really think that he did a marvelous job, but there really weren't any bad performances in there. I think that they all captured the essence of their characters, and some of them had larger roles than other. Comedian was a little bit two-dimensional. But that was intentional. They were trying to say that this was what his worldview was, and then trying to show how it contrasts to the worldview of everybody else, and where he was right and where he was wrong. In more ways than one, he was a MacGuffin.
One of the funny aspects of things was that when Jeffrey Dean Morgan was originally offered the part of the comedian, he started reading the script and got to page 3 and went, "The character dies! Why would I want to play this character? He gets killed off in the first 3 pages!" And he called up his agent and he said, "Why do you want me to do this?" And the agent said, "Keep reading." Once he got to the end of the screenplay, he realized, wow, this is a really powerful character. And he jumped at the chance to play it.
It is. I don't want to say he's the string that holds the story together, but his life touches everyone in the story.
One of the best examples of this is at his funeral. And you have the heroes lined up at the gravesite reflecting back on their memories of the comedian. And they flash back to these points in time where he had an impact on their lives. And in every single one of them, it was a turning point for them where they realized, oh, we've crossed the line, or, oh, he's crossed the line and I can never go that route.
I think that's one of the smartest comments you've made on this show. I really hadn't thought about that, and I just think that's an incredible revelation to me. I saw it, and it just went right over my head.
Yeah, you need to learn how to pay attention more.
Yeah. Patience, how long does that take?
It's funny, because scenes like that were among my favorites of the movie. And I know that there's people out there who are going to go, oh, the best part of the movie was when Dr. Manhattan created the Mars house, and oh, that was so graphically beautiful and wonderful. And that was just special effects to me. That wasn't storytelling. It was the storytelling aspects that really jumped out at me and made me go, wow, this is a really good movie.
Oh, that's one of the reasons I think this works as a comic book. And possibly Alan Moore would feel that it can't translate to the movies, because on paper you have basically your art and your story. And on film you have so much more that can really take over it. If you just let ILM or Digital Domain or one of those companies go in there, they can go crazy on a movie. You never have to see an actor's performance. So you have to balance. And this is, I guess, in my perspective, this is a directorial decision. Where are you going to go with the movie? Is it going to be all special effects, all story, or is it going to be a happy medium? And this was certainly a happy medium because the special effects were top notch. I mean, they were absolutely spectacular, but they weren't the story. They were the tools that helped tell the story.
The Mars house, I thought, looked really cool, and the moving parts and everything, I looked at and went, that's some pretty good CGI. Wow, it really blows the jungle scene from Indiana Jones right out of the water.
But it didn't distract you from the dialogue. What was important in the main scenes on Mars was the dialogue that was going on between Dr. Manhattan and Silk Spectre.
Again, another fantastic scene when she's talking to him about his humanity and lack thereof, and just great character development. One of the key points of the entire story is right there. And you know that there are going to be people who are going to sit there and go, look, that piece of the house over there is moving, isn't that cool? And they're going to miss all of that good dialogue. But then there's also going to be the people who will sit there and go, wow, that was some fantastic storytelling. And both people are going to be happy.
Yeah, and I have to say, a third aspect is the choreographers for the fight scenes. These were some of the best comic book fight scenes I've ever seen. They're just really well told. There's a little bit of that Matrix bullet time stuff in there, but it's not overdone. They look very realistic, and these people look heroic.
Speaking of the fight scenes, I am going to take this opportunity to say, if you have a child under the age of 17, and unless you're really open-minded, you're going to want to wait on this film. I cannot, in good conscience, recommend it for anybody under the age of 18.
Well, I don't know if I would go that far, but I will say this movie did earn its rated R for violence. So if you do not appreciate violence and a little bit of gore, you will not appreciate this movie as much because it really, really earns that R.
It earns the R in violence, it earns the R in nudity, it earns the R in language. It earns its R well.
Actually, I think that's a good segue, because there was certainly nudity, equal opportunity in this movie, but I don't think that it was gratuitous.
No, actually, it was all very well done within the confines of the story. It was understandable as to why it was there. I do think that we could have had about 5 or 6 less shots of Dr. Manhattan's Long Island, if you know what I mean. But it's part of the story. It's in the comic book. It's right there.
It was part of the original creative vision, if you will.
So I can't complain about it.
It's interesting because it's one of those things that Dr. Manhattan's nudity doesn't advance the story in and of itself. But what it's doing is it's showing you just how alien Dr. Manhattan is. There's no reason for him to wear clothing. He's not part of society. He's not adhering to our rules. It's just he does his own thing.
And again, digging into the deeper meaning of things, him having no problem with nudity, him walking around naked almost all of the time, brings a symbolism to the character of a new Adam. They talk about him being the first Superman. He's the first of a new race of people. So having him walk around naked likens him to a new Adam.
That's the second smartest thing you've said on this show.
However, special correspondent Matt Halloran has some friends who work out there. One of them does CGI work, and this particular person actually got put onto the Watchmen project to work on Dr. Manhattan. Now, he wasn't the person, but imagine, if you will, your job being to animate Dr. Manhattan's Long Island, making sure that it swings properly with movement and things like that. That's your job. Not something that I'd want to go to college for. I read the comic book just under 20 years ago. I read it in the graphic novel format that it got reprinted in for that year. And to be honest, it was a little confusing for me. I didn't like it because it was my first exposure to the gray area superhero. And it was not a concept that I was particularly comfortable with at the time. I was 19 and still relatively immature, so I really wasn't that big of a fan of it until I got older and started to understand some of the symbolism and some of the ideas that were being presented in it. I needed to mature in order to fully appreciate it for the piece of art that it was. I felt the new movie captured all of the positive things that I can appreciate of the story now, and I actually enjoyed many of the changes that were made. I thought that the way the movie concludes made far more sense than The Squid. And those of you who haven't seen the movie or aren't that familiar with it, you'll understand.
Well, here's a case where we're pretty much in agreement. I read the comic book 21 years ago or so. You know, it didn't strike me one way or another. It was just simply an exercise in storytelling for me. I enjoyed it. I didn't see it as groundbreaking new innovation. I was just like, okay, this is a story. I understand, you know, in the years that have passed, it's come to be one of the greats of visual storytelling literature. I'd have to go back and reread it to see if I really agree with that or not. I don't necessarily automatically disagree with it. To me, it was just a story with characters I really wasn't familiar with. One of the complaints that I heard from a couple of reviewers is that if you hadn't read the comic book and if you weren't a big fan, that you weren't going to be able to follow this movie. And it's been well over 20 years since I've read the comic book, and I've got to disagree with that. It is well told, it's not linear, but the way it's told, it does not need to be linear.
If you need this movie to be linear, then you need to go on out, you need to expand your sampling of movies that you've seen, you need to expand your taste in literature, because there are nice, smooth transitions here.
This movie is actually told like peeling an onion. You've got the outer layer of the onion, which is your overall story. And again, this is the comedian MacGuffin. You've got a costume superhero being killed and what's going on. And then you peel back that layer, and you've got this group of people that have either grown up with or grown up around him, and you start to see what's going on in their lives. And then you peel that back, and you get to some more questions, like, why is this going on? Somebody knows something. We've got to find that. It becomes just this intricate, well-told story that does not need a narrator, doesn't need somebody explaining it to you. It's just one layer after another, and they just peel off very nicely in a fashion that anybody can understand.
If I had to pick one negative thing to say about this film, it's the fact that they did have a narrator-esque feel in using Rorschach's journal to fill in information. And while it was very pertinent information, and I appreciated the way that they did it, it seemed a little long at times. And as I said, Haley did a great job with the performance and the voice, but you start listening to Rorschach talk for 5 minutes straight, and it starts getting a little bit on your nerves, because he talks in that deep, growly, irritable voice. And you listen to that for an extended period of time, and you start going, the hairs on the back of my neck are starting to stand up. Can you stop just for a little bit, please?
Ultimately, the movie itself may not have had a 100% faithful adaptation of the comic book. The ending has changed, there are some things that are left out, but they don't tell the story. Even if it isn't the exact artist concept, it certainly is faithful.
I think Alan Moore's complaints about this film are completely unfounded. It comes across as he's more concerned about, you didn't tell my story the exact way that I told it, so therefore I'm going to throw a hissy fit, than, did you try to get the points across that I tried to make? And I feel as though they did a great job of getting those points across. You knew the environment that was going on around these people. You're in the middle of a Cold War. Nuclear attacks could happen at any time. The fear that surrounded people every single day of that time period. The fact that people were looking out only for themselves. Big businesses were looking out only for the profit. All these points were there. They did a great job of towing his agenda and telling a great story.
That's a good point about big business. Do you think this movie itself is big business?
Oh, God, yes. Before the movie ever came out, they had already released two separate DVDs. They've put out Tales of the Black Freighter, which is an animated film telling the story of the comic book within the comic book that, thank goodness, they just completely ignored in the movie. They released a comic animation version where they've taken images from the comic book and they've put motion to them and released that. There are plans to release at least two, and quite possibly three, different versions of The Watchmen on DVD at three different times. A theatrical version, a extended cut version, and a director's cut version. Trying to get people to buy three different copies of this DVD. They often talk about how many times can a movie be taken back to the well? How many times can a company hit the consumer trying to get more money out of them with the exact same piece of merchandise? And some companies do it smart. They'll release it, and then 2 or 3 years later, they might go, okay, well, we're going to release an extended cut, and it makes it look like something that they thought of after the fact. Oh, yeah, you know, let's throw a couple of extra special features on there. We don't sell this version anymore. We'll throw in some extra features and release it again for those who didn't get it the first time. With this, they're making it perfectly clear. We want you to buy as many copies of this as you can, because we want to get more and more and more rich. I mean, it reminds me of Paramount whoring out Star Trek as much as they do.
Alan Moore's got so outrageous. Why do they want him to be so rich? More and more and more rich. But yes, your comment on Star Trek is well taken. I mean, they've got the original theatrical releases out on DVD. They have the special edition releases out on DVD. And then they're putting out the original theatrical releases again on Blu-ray, which to me says that they're going to put the special editions out again on Blu-ray. And they're just going to hoard out as many times as they can.
And for as much as they can.
It's the oldest profession, Jim.
So the two questions that come to mind are, Are they going to alienate potential buyers by bringing it back to the well too many times? Are people going to go, well, I'm not going to buy it on DVD the first time it comes out with just the theatrical release, because I already know that there's going to be a director's cut and an extended release, and I'll choose from one of them. Of course, I fully believe that, much like there are comic book collectors out there who will buy 5 copies of the 5 different covers of the same comic book just so that they have a complete collection, there will be people who will go on out and they will buy all 3 versions of Watchmen. But I can wait a year for the version of Watchmen that I want, knowing that it will be coming out.
I think we've come to a point now where the consumers are smart enough that the companies actually producing the DVDs have outthought themselves. Once upon a time, it really was. Movie comes out, it's the theatrical version, and the only thing that's on the DVD is that and the trailer. And then a year later, 18 months later, they come out with a special edition that has 2 discs in it, has a documentary on the making of the film, and interviews with the cast and crew, and they're giving you something to spend that extra money on. And nowadays, they're like, well, why wait a year and a half? So you come out with something like Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Holy Crap, and it comes out with a director's release, it comes out with a single disc release, and it comes out with a dual disc or 3 disc release all on the same day.
And if they did that with The Watchmen, I could actually understand it and appreciate it. I could say, okay, you're giving us 3 different choices, not a problem here. But by releasing it at 3 different time periods, it really feels like they're saying, okay, we want you to buy the first one because we know that you're going to want it as soon as it comes out, and then we expect you to buy it the second time because we're going to have a couple extra features on there, and then we're going to expect you to buy it the third time because we're going to have a few more extra features on there, but you can't wait until that last copy because we're going to leave some special features off of that one that were on the second one. So this way, we can try to triple dip you.
You can see right now that they've really hit the well too many times, and they don't know how to deal with it. The DC Universe Wonder Woman. If you buy it at one store, the DVD comes with an action figure. If you buy it at another store, it comes with a unique comic book. If you buy it at another store yet, it comes with something else. So in order to get you to buy the exact same thing 3 times, it actually is packaged differently for each individual store.
The oldest profession. So if Alan Moore really wanted to complain about something, that is what he should be complaining about. Taking one of the key components of his story and, in real life, just pooping all over it. Don't worry about whether or not they included your giant squid.
I've seen Dr. Manhattan, they included the giant squid.
Worry about the fact that they're treating your creation like a 50-cent whore. Or in this case, $22.95. So, Doug, how many pens in the pocket protector?
I give this movie 4 pens in the pocket protector. Well, enjoyable movie. I don't think it'll make as much money as I would like it to just because of the time period it's coming out, but this was a really good movie.
I would say probably 3 to 3.5 pens in the pocket protector out of 4. I'm always stingy with my pens. In other words, we say definitely go see it as long as you're over 18.
Well, Twerp fans, before we bid you adieu today, we just want to do a quick follow-up to our last episode, the Oscar cast, and our predictions. We did pretty good. We managed to get 5 out of 7 of the big numbers.
We both kind of blew it on supporting actress, and we split the 2 categories that we didn't agree in.
It was Kate Winslet's year, and I gotta say, having been wrong with Sean Penn, I can't argue with their decision. He was just so amazing that if I was going to be wrong on anything, I'm glad that I was wrong about Sean Penn. And then Best Supporting Actress, I think you can argue whether or not she deserved it for this movie. But when you look at Penelope Cruz's body of work, not just her body, it's good, but her body of work, that she really deserves some sort of recognition. She is awesome.
I'm just waiting to see what Brad Pitt actually does end up getting the Oscar for, and whether it's going to be as worthwhile as Benjamin Button.
I don't think so. I think that it will eventually go like The Reader. It will just go, this is going to be Brad Pitt's year. I so doubt that he'll get it for a movie he's done a decent job in. I mean, the only thing worse than The Reader that I saw this year was The Wrestler. At least that got left out completely. I don't think I would ever have watched it again if Heath Ledger hadn't. Whether or not you want to say, okay, it was Heath Ledger's year because he's not going to get another chance, that's a little over the top, but he did earn it. I mean, he was something else. And just going back and watching some of his other performances, he really was a decent actor. I think he's going to be missed.
For more thoughts and reflections about Oscar cast, feel free to visit our Facebook page or our Zynga page or our MySpace page, where we will be doing occasional posts of both upcoming TWRP projects and reflections on things that we may say here. You can also use those as a great opportunity to get in touch with us, as well as emailing us.
Speaking of email, please feel free to send us your thoughts and or comments to jim@twerponline.net.
Thank you for joining us. TWRPcast is a production of Timewheel Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2009.
No, we are not like your ordinary supervillains. We accomplished our goal 35 minutes ago.